Welcome to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Michael Sukoff in studio with Peter Phillips. On today's show, we'll talk about radical sociology and how radical sociological approaches to understanding important events and problems in the world today might help us as citizens, media consumers, and activists to think more critically about the deeper issues that are at stake, as well as how we might formulate responses to them. We hope you'll stay tuned. This is the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Michael Sukoff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today we're talking about radical sociology and how it can help address problems such as the increasing growth of global inequality. Our guests today are Michael J. Thompson, professor of political science at William Patterson University, Francis Fox Piven, distinguished professor of political science at the City University of New York Graduate Center, and William Robinson, professor of sociology at UC Santa Barbara. Peter?
What is radical sociology? According to the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, the English word radical comes from the Latin radicalis, which means going to the bottom or root of something. For Karl Marx, to be radical meant to go to the root of a problem and involved in part the ruthless criticism of all that exists. For C. Wright Mills, one of the prominent radical sociologists of our era, the task of sociology was to demonstrate the connections between what he called personal troubles and public issues. Today we will discuss what radical sociology is, how it looks at issues like social and economic inequality, and what radical sociological approach to problems like these might mean today.
Our first guest today is Michael J. Thompson. Dr. Thompson is professor of political theory in the Department of Political Science at William Patterson University, where he offers classes in political theory, political sociology, and the history of political thought. He is the author of The Politics of Inequality, The Domestication of Critical Theory, and the forthcoming Twilight of the Self, The Eclipse of Autonomy in Modern Society. His areas of research include political and social theory, moral philosophy, critical theory, German idealism, and Western Marxism. He is also the founder and executive director of Logos, a journal of modern society and culture. Welcome to the Project Censored show, Michael Thompson.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Michael.
We want to talk to you today about radical sociology. And as Peter indicated, what we mean roughly by radical sociology is the attempt to go to the roots of problems and to find ways to figure out how to address these problems in the real world. So let me start out by just asking what radical sociology means to you.
What's resonant when I hear radical sociology really is the idea that there has to be some kind of confrontation with those forces in society, those powers that seek to constrain and limit our freedom as members of society. And I think that can come in two forms. One is in terms of our consciousness. In other words, that there's ways that elites or those in power in hierarchical societies are able to change the ideas that we live under and live with. And the second is the concrete, real conditions of our lives, materially, legally, the legal structure of the society. And radical sociology has to be about, I think, critiquing and in many ways contesting those kind of forms that are projected onto us. To me, I think that's really its most important function, because perhaps the greatest danger of modern society is the passive acceptance of authority and the control by elites of our lives, of everyday life, and the purposes of the community as a whole. And I think that's a legitimate fear. And I think it's a fear that today, especially the first two decades of the 21st century, is probably more important now than it has been in the past.
Michael, you've written two books recently, or edited essays. One was called The Common Good, The Principle of Social Justice, and the other was The Demise of the Radical Critique of Economic Inequality in Western Political Thought. Could you elaborate on those ideas?
I can start with the second one. I really think that what we've been witnessing over the past several decades, especially since the 1980s, 1970s and 80s, with the eclipse of the student movements and the social movements from the 1960s, has been a kind of erosion of contestation of power. And I think that economic inequality is probably one of the most important kind of arenas where you can see this, that there really has been not only a demise of the critique of economic inequality, but there's been this kind of shift on some level also to a kind of legitimation of inequalities. And I think one of the ways that's happened is that elites have been really successful in reorganizing our ideas about what the common good really is. And I think that they've been able to basically reprogram us into thinking that the common good is synonymous with the healthy economic dynamics of a capitalist society. I think this has become deeply ingrained in a lot of our institutions. And also the dominant elites, not only in politics, but also in journalism and in the academy, in the social sciences. So I really think that radical sociology, a renewal of radical sociology, would mean, like I said before, a kind of rethinking of how we oppose these kind of ideologies. Because I think with economic inequality in particular, there has been, and there continues to be, a kind of naturalization of this hierarchy within American society in particular. What we are seeing is this kind of weakening of all of those institutions and forms of social organization that in the past were the kind of reservoirs for a kind of countervailing power. So the breakdown of unions, the breakdown of working class solidarity, the breakdown of consciousness of working class solidarity in the workplace and in general. And I think this is really constitutes a kind of eclipse of these kind of countervailing forces toward elite control.
Michael Thompson, as you know, on Project Censor, we're very concerned with media coverage and stories that either do not get covered or get distorted by the mainstream corporate media. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you might address some of your remarks, which are already very apropos, specifically to the media and the public sphere and how in that realm people's ways of thinking about issues in the world and how they're perceived and what they're led not to think about are relevant in terms of what you just said here.
This is a really important aspect to this argument. The media has been increasingly corporatized, obviously, over the past 20, 30 years. There's been effectively a control over what is considered the legitimate way of thinking about politics and the economy. More important than that, I think, actually, is the kind of way that popular culture has shifted and been shaped and formed over the past 30, 40 years. You can really see, in many ways, a kind of almost celebration, this kind of elite bourgeois way of living. When I was a kid, the kind of television shows that people would have watched on broadcast television focused on working class families, for the most part, through the 70s and 80s, you would see like a middle class, middle to working class kinds of families reflected in your kind of life world, in everyday life. You would have seen this on television, whether it was All in the Family or Roseanne or something like this. And I think in the 90s, you started to see this shift. You started to see that the kind of television programs, the kind of popular culture people would consume, started to move toward this very, very different kind of set of norms. You get Sex in the City and you get these kind of other kinds of shows. I think there's been a real shift in the kind of tacit way that people see what their own personal values ought to be, what is considered good or beautiful or successful. And this is a really important building block for ideological consciousness. And more importantly, because it really does cement some legitimation or legitimacy to the system.
Taking this more into the overt, say, political arena, we've got increasing and vast disparities in wealth and power, and that's reflected across the globe, and particularly in the United States. So in addition to acknowledging and understanding and addressing these issues of where people's consciousness is politically, socially, and culturally, how would a radical sociological approach to these issues what would it look like in terms of addressing these more objective structural inequalities and disparities in wealth and power?
If you talk about it from the perspective of radical sociology, then one of its primary tasks has to be the kind of critique and breakdown of the predominant theories that really uphold the kind of legitimation for the policies that you talk about. Hand in hand with this rise in inequality has been also a kind of conformity to a kind of mainstream approach to the study of society and economics and politics within the academy. In the 60s and 70s and even in the early 80s, there would have been much more of a pluralism, even within the economics discipline itself, right? You would have Marxism, Marx's ideas were still given attention in mainstream economics textbooks. Today, there's been a complete transformation about how theories of societies work. There's almost just one lens from which you can see these phenomena. And I think that this has had a big effect on not only everyday life of people, but it's had a big effect on the way that policy is constructed, that there's only kind of one very narrow kind of view about how economic policy should be conducted, about how social policy can be constructed. And the radical sociology's real value at that level is to do work that really does challenge and offset the intellectual hegemony of these ideas. Because in many ways, the expansion of inequality is, of course, a material reality. But these things are only possible because there was a reconstruction of the political and legal framework within which economic activities operated. And you can see this if you look back to, the New Deal, the 30s, and the kind of intellectuals that were shaping policy had a very, very different view about the role of capitalism and the role of the economy in society. And they created a legal political framework, which is very, very different from the kind of neoliberal legal political framework that dominates now. So radical sociology has to be, I view it, as a central concern, that there has to be a way to undermine and contest the kind of theoretical hegemony, because this really does bleed into not only regular social policy, it also constricts the kind of political imagination of people that another way of organizing the polity and the economy is possible. And that's really radical sociology's most important contribution.
Michael, the dominance of neoliberal philosophy today in economics and the media around the country, around the world, is a top-down support of wealth, recognition and awarding the ideology of wealth, and destruction of any sort of welfare or social assistance programs as unwarranted. Could you talk about the dominance of neoliberalism in today's society?
The dominance of neoliberalism is both an ideological reality, and it's also a kind of new sociological reality. We're kind of regressing sociologically away from the idea that there even is a common good. And if you look at the predominant kind of everyday way of thinking, the way that we're conceived of as consumers, for example, it's a complete atomization of society, that each individual is out for him or herself. But it's not just ideological, this is real. There is a real sense in which the ideology matches with the reality that hierarchies undermining forms of social solidarity and connection, this is real. Neoliberalism, in that respect, is going to continue to be successful so long as it's able to convince people that this reality is somehow just natural and there's nothing that you can do to change it. And I think the difference of wealth today from the kind of wealth of an industrial society is that in post-industrial societies, wealth is not only able to grow much more exponentially, but that the kind of ways that the wealth is able to integrate itself into technology and the system of information. This is a very new kind of hurdle for radicals to overcome.
Michael Thompson, given what you've just said and given the material and ideological hegemony of the existing system or the existing state of affairs, it seems like that configuration needs to be attacked and addressed on both of those levels simultaneously. So what do you think is necessary at this time, and perhaps we can start to move towards some empirical examples, of how this kind of ideological hegemony of people accepting things the way they are can be questioned and undermined?
This is really the most important question. First of all, I don't think it's really ever possible to predict where a movement is going to come from. No one predicted, for example, the Arab Spring. No one predicted Occupy Wall Street. There's no way to predict where a movement is going to come and what it's going to say. There is, however, a responsibility for the radical sociologist to evaluate and be involved with whatever movements emerge and to try to help shape those movements based on the kind of empirical work that we do as social scientists and theorists. But the truth of the matter is, any movements that emerge that do not address, this is my view at least, that do not address the fundamental hierarchies within the social order in terms of its economic structure are not going to be progressive in some really essential way. It will still be captured by the language of liberalism. In other words, identity politics and so on, these kind of movements are still captured within the kind of grammar, the language of liberalism, in the sense that each segment of the society is looking for recognition for their rights, which is not a negative thing in and of itself. What moves it from a liberal movement to a radical movement, I think, is that the radical movement is able to find a way into the spinal column of the society at large, and that is the economic order itself. Because capitalism, neoliberal capitalism, has absolutely no problem with much of the identities that are unfolding, transgender, homosexual marriage. Only when it's wrapped up with class, the more braided it is with class, the more braided it is with the economic order of property and power, then it becomes intractable. And I think that's why you see racial problems as being more persistent, more difficult to solve, for example, than questions of sexuality or those forms of identity politics. So any movement that emerges has to be pushed toward, in my view, has to be informed by and pushed toward a critique of the social order, and has to be involved with the critique of wealth, of inequality of wealth. And that means capitalism. And that means the kind of relationships that you have in your workplace, but also as a consumer, that you are being expropriated from, that the fundamental basis of wealth is extraction from others. And that once you leave that kind of language, or that kind of insight about the root of capitalist society, then you're moving away from any kind of radical movement.
We're talking with Michael Thompson, professor of political theory at the Department of Political Science at William Patterson University, where he teaches political sociology and the history of political thought. Michael, this is intriguing, that social movements like Occupy, which did hit at the root of capitalism, they really gave us the mantra of 1%, 99%, which is now everywhere and is understood. So that foundation is present. And so new social movements or critiques in that realm have that already. So what we're talking about here is what builds the core of that. And I'd like to address something I teach in all my classes, and that is human rights, or the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, doesn't get taught. And following that as a code, as a moral standard, might be an important part of future political movements.
Two things. I think that is an important thing. I want to go back to the Occupy Wall Street insight for a second, because I was involved with the very beginnings of it when it kind of broke out here in New York. And I do think that the beginnings of the Occupy movement were very important because it was talking about issues of class and issues of economics. It was an opening. It was a beginning. That did not go far enough. I think talking about the 1% versus the 99% is very powerful, very important, and very fruitful. But that's not the same thing, because it doesn't quite yet necessarily achieve the level of being radical. And I mean this in the sense that there are ways to address economic inequality that fall within a liberal framework, and there are ways of addressing inequality that fall within a radical framework. The liberal solution is some forms of redistribution or welfare statism. In other words, you maintain the status quo, but just trying to weaken the kind of blunt edges of the system. Radicalism, the way I view it, is the imagination of an alternative way of viewing society. Now, later on, within Occupy, that began to, in some ways, emerge, with trying to organize different ways of community and things like that. But any radical critique of the social order has to be founded on the idea that it's not just that there's this wealth inequality, but that this wealth inequality is generated by particular social relationships that are extractive and exploitive. And the less that that becomes the main target, the less radical that that becomes. And I think with the question of human rights, that there hasn't been enough discussion. And this connects back to the question of the common good or the common interest. The most fundamental question any member of a society should ask him or herself is, are the institutions, are the social norms and practices, the things I'm involved with, are these things worth my allegiance? Is there something that I get from this society that's good? Is this society in some way contributing to a kind of flourishing individuality? If it is not, then that's where the moment of radical critique has to begin.
Michael Thompson, this has been a wonderfully rich discussion. Thank you so much for joining us, and hopefully we can continue another time.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Michael Sukoff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today we're discussing radical sociology. We'll be right back after a musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Michael Sukoff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today we're discussing radical sociology and how it can help address problems in the world today.
Our next guest is sociology professor Frances Fox Piven. She was a professor of political science and sociology at the Graduate School, City University of New York, where she's taught since 1982 and is now emeritus. One of her groundbreaking works was a book with Richard Cloward on the functions of social welfare called Regulating the Poor, which received front page coverage in the New York Times Book Review and ignited a scholarly debate that reshaped the entire field of social welfare policy. Piven is an author and co-author of more than 200 articles and published in various academic journals, books, popular publications since 1965. Welcome, Frances Fox Piven.
Glad to talk to you.
Today we're talking about the theme of radical sociology. And I want to just start things off with you by getting a sense of what radical sociology means to you, both in terms of the way you think about issues and the way you've approached your work over the years.
Well, I suppose that radical sociology is a sociology that is critical of the society in which we live, that tries to understand the basic dynamics of that society, to criticize it, and to search for alternative dynamics that can change the society. I think sociologists tend to be what most people would call more radical because, after all, they're not chemists or computer nerds. They're focused on collective life, so they pay attention to the patterns of group making and the patterns of conflict in the society around them. And they're critical of those patterns frequently, not always, which is what most people think of as radical. Doesn't necessarily mean that they search for the true essence of society, but it does mean that they look at society in a critical way, try to compare this society, however that's defined, with other societies and try to understand the process of change that is always ongoing in a society like ours.
And to help our listeners out a little bit, could you say a little bit more about what does critical mean in this context?
Well, sociologists, for example, pay a lot of attention, or some of them do at least, to patterns of difference and inequality within our own society or within similar societies. A critical approach to those patterns, to patterns of class and racial differentiation, would first make clear the human costs of ongoing patterns, and second, search for levers of change. What are the possibilities for altering the dynamics that give rise to class differentiation and racial differentiation?
The philosophy of neoliberalism and its dominance in corporate media and economics today, and then ongoing austerity programs where we're cutting back on social service programs and human needs is reflective of your book going back to 1971, Regulating the Poor. And certainly that book was almost a forerunner of where we've been led to.
Yeah, I agree. In a way, it was a forerunner, but it was an attempt to characterize the patterns that had dominated policy for a millennia in the treatment of the poor. And in a way, it extended from those patterns. It tried to draw essential dynamics out of those patterns that applied to the present and maybe to the future. And it also searched for ways of breaking what you might call the cycles, which led to extreme want and poverty and misery at the bottom of the society, all in the ostensible name of putting people to work.
I read your book in 71 when it came out. I was working in the War on Poverty at the time.
Sure.
And so it really laid out for me, especially when I went to grad school, the overriding control of elites in the country and the emphasis and regulation of poor people and the emphasis on requiring that somehow they needed to be taught what work was and encouraged to do work, even though it was drudgery in some cases. That theme in your book was powerful, and I think it's continued. I mean, when I say it was a forerunner, I mean that what we're facing today, cut back on food stamps and a variety of other things, all with that same theme.
All with the same justification, that the reason that people are poor is that they're undisciplined, that they don't want to work. And it has been the major preoccupation of Western elites since, I would say, the 17th century. And if that's the main preoccupation, you're never going to have policies that make it possible for people at the bottom of the society to flourish, to live a decent life, to be able to raise their children without hunger, without acute insecurity. In order to do that, you have to have a policy that breaks with a tradition of using the poor in a sense to discipline workers, because that's what we do. We use the poor and we use our harsh treatment of the poor to scare other people who are pretty close to poverty themselves into working and working harder and harder and harder. That pattern was justified in the 19th century by English poor law commissioners brought together presumably to reform the poor law system or the welfare system. And they announced as a kind of root principle of social policy the idea of less eligibility, the idea that the poor must be worse off than any worker, even the least eligible worker. And the reason for that is that when that less eligible worker, that worker who works too hard, too many hours for too little pay, when they look at the kind of spectacle the society has created of the very poor, they shudder and they go back to work.
Francis Piven, I'm wondering if we could take the comment you just made and talk about the economic and social inequalities and the ideological discipline that enforces those in the United States today. When we had talked before this interview, you had mentioned the West Virginia teacher strike, and perhaps that would be a flip side example of what enables certain individuals or workers or groups of workers to break through this sort of ideological consensus and fight back.
That's true. That's right. Well, the United States has become, over the last half century, the most unequal country in the world. It's the richest country in the world, but it's the most unequal. And that's not only because we have a tiny stratum at the top that is fabulously wealthy. It's also because we have a stratum at the bottom that is miserably poor and insecure and disrespected. I think we have to emphasize that poverty is not just a material condition. It's a condition in which people are not allowed to have any dignity, any self-respect. They're not allowed full membership in the society. In those respects, the United States has gotten much, much worse over the last 50 years. Too many rich, rich, rich people, and far too many deeply impoverished people. That has gone along with, because it always does, the deteriorating circumstances of people who are not miserably poor, but they're poor. They're working poor. They're the millions, tens of millions of people in the United States who have jobs and who have the modicum of self-respect that goes with having a steady job, but their take-home pay has been shrinking steadily for probably 40 years. And one of the reasons for that is that we have been in the grip of a kind of business offensive dating, I think, from the early 1970s, in which business has been making bigger and bigger claims on our collective wealth. And it has had a lot of political success as well as economic success. And part of the campaign has been to destroy unions. Unions, mass unionism in the United States. We've had unions for a long time. A lot of them have been craft unions. But mass unions date from the 1930s, and public sector unions, unions of firemen and teachers and street cleaners, date from the 1960s. Well, in order to roll back what is the share that workers finally came to claim on our collective wealth, in order to roll that back, big business launched a campaign to break unions. And it's a campaign that has been remarkably successful. We have gone from a situation in the 1950s, say, where about a third of American workers enjoyed the protection of a union, and many other workers who weren't in the union, in a sense, enjoyed the protection of these unions, because these unions set the wage scales of many people who were not even in the unions. And these unions also were an important political force, shaping public policies that bore on the lives of workers. Well, beginning in the 1950s, but escalating, especially in the 1970s and 80s, when Reagan became president and Republicans took over the Congress, there has been a concerted campaign to roll back unionism. Part of that campaign has been the development of a union-busting business in the United States. It's kind of interesting. These are PR firms, PR and legal firms, that teach employers how to prevent unions or bust unions that have already taken hold in the workplace. And we haven't had these union-busting firms since the 19th century. This is a revival of a practice that we thought had disappeared, that we thought we had advanced to become progressive enough as a society to allow workers to organize. But no, the union-busting campaign rolled back union levels from about a third of the workforce to about 7% of the workforce, mainly in the private sector. But there were some unions that were able to hold out because they were public sector unions and could use, in a way, their numbers and their lobbying ability to keep a foothold in the public sector. Those unions are now under assault by organized business. Organized business has become politically very adept. They have a whole armory of strategies. They have networks of nonprofits that basically work for political business firms. So these business firms have been the force behind state-level campaigns to bust public sector unions, because public sector unions have managed to hold out a little bit. So in the states, the state legislatures are passing right-to-work laws and, of course, making it illegal for public sector workers to strike.
Dr. Piven, in face of all you've described, nevertheless, just to fast forward again, we do have phenomena like the wildcat strikes of the West Virginia teachers,
yes,
who actually took action in the face of their union telling them to accept the contract that was originally offered. So how would you explain something like that in these terms?
Explain it the way I always explain the eruption, the explosion of social movements, the social movements that sometimes bring a little humanity into our societies. The great strikes of the 1930s by industrial workers were not led by unions either. They were rather eruptions of indignation and heroism by rank-and-file workers. I think that's what happened in West Virginia, and I think it's going to happen. I hope it's going to happen, and I think it will, in Oklahoma, and I hope it will spread to other states as well. That's the main way that poor people, working people, defend themselves in a very rapacious society. And we live in a very rapacious society. They defend themselves by exploding in indignation and beginning to defy the rules that ordinarily ensure their cooperation. That's what the West Virginia teachers did. And they did it essentially without a union. That's so important for people to see, that this capacity emanated from the collective life of the teachers and their capacity to recognize that they did have some power. They had the power to close the schools. That's a power that unions are now too timid to use. But it's the essential power that ordinary people have, the power to shut it down.
We're speaking with Frances Fox Piven, American professor of political science and sociology at the Graduate Center at City University of New York, a longtime professor there. You were one of the organizers originally of the National Welfare Rights Organization. And this was poor people on welfare saying that we have human rights as well. Welfare has been so weakened, it's now called temporary assistance. It doesn't really exist as a support mechanism for keeping people out of poverty anymore. So people are still desperate. What happens with the surplus labor force, people who get by on welfare, unemployment, or nothing in this country? Is there some way that that group, who aren't working, can organize, or do you see some way of organizing them in a fashion that challenges wealth concentration and neoliberalism?
Well, I actually think that it's only when people at the bottom come together and find the courage and the wherewithal to become defiant that we ever really reform our policies toward the poor. Those are the occasions in which the old welfare system became a little bit more liberal, a little bit more generous in the 1930s and the 1960s in the United States, for example. But apart from the poor posing the threat of disorder, what we get is a lot of talk about reform. We get a lot of talk about how these people ought to get an education, how they ought to shape up, and how we ought to give them training programs. But the real reforms, which have a measurable effect on poverty, are the result of explosions of defiance, of strikes of a kind, but the strikes in this case by people who don't have jobs. They're strikes against an institutional system which attempts to regulate their behavior, and they defy that institutional system.
We're talking with Francis Fox Piven, distinguished professor emerita of political science at the City University of New York Graduate Center. Dr. Piven, in finishing, I am wondering if the kinds of things you're suggesting in terms of workers' capacity to recognize what's in their interests and acting upon them, whether or not these same kinds of radical capacities would carry over to other issues that don't affect people's everyday economic or other concerns. I'm thinking about things like nuclear weapons, climate breakdown, and so forth. Would you add a comment about that?
Well, I think that people are probably best positioned to have a piercing and critical analysis about the things that they themselves experience. When we're talking about nuclear weapons or even climate change, then sadly, to be sure, but people are much more susceptible to propaganda. The great challenge, in a way, to democratic processes in our society is that collective life has become very complicated. Government has become very complicated, and that makes people much more susceptible to propaganda. So what are the forces that can bring some light to democratic publics? Probably social movements that cultivate an alternative analysis and a radical critique of everything that exists, everything now existing. But apart from that, we're in trouble.
On that note, hopefully there are more and better things to come. Francis Fox Piven, thank you so much for joining us today on the Project Censored Show.
Thank you for calling.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Michael Sukoff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today we're discussing radical sociology and radical sociological approaches to problems in the world today. After a musical break, we'll be back with William Robinson. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Michael Sukoff in studio with Peter Phillips. Our next guest is William I. Robinson. William I. Robinson is professor of sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. His scholarly research focuses on globalization and transnationalism, political economy, political sociology, development, and social change, and on Latin America and the Third World and Latino-Latina studies. His forthcoming book is Into the Tempest, Essays on the New Global Capitalism from Haymarket Press. Welcome to the Project Censored Show, William Robinson.
Pleasure to be on.
Today we're talking about radical sociology and what a radical sociological approach to current issues and problems might be. We mentioned earlier Marx's approach to radical sociology, which entailed the ruthless criticism of everything existing, as well as going to the root of issues coming from the Latin. What's your sense of what radical sociology is and how you approach it through your work?
First of all, radical sociology is getting to the root of social phenomenon, of society, of what's going on in society. But for the 21st century, for our times, radical sociology can only involve the critique of capitalism. We live under global capitalism, and we can't understand anything about society, about dynamics, about conflict, about all of the burning social and political issues of our day without critiquing capitalism. And radical sociology is a very powerful instrument for critiquing capitalism, which is why radical sociology has been pulled back, challenged, and diluted ever since its heyday in the 1960s and 1970s.
For those of our listeners who aren't well-versed in Marxist sociology or even Marx's critique of capital, how would you boil that down in terms of what it means to criticize capitalism and how that kind of critique could inform our theory and politics today?
The critique of capitalism acknowledges the obvious, acknowledges that the vast majority of the world's wealth and resources in the hands of tiny groups of people, and that the system is leading to an ever-increasing levels of inequality, increasing levels of oppression and exploitation, and it's also leading to conflict everywhere, and we're headed towards, if we don't have a change of course, towards World War III, escalating conflicts all around the world. All of this is linked to the dynamics of the system of capitalism. You mentioned Marx. I mean, the reason Marx is so important is that Marx was the first one to systematically analyze the nature of the capitalist system and its dynamics and link it to all of these burning social and political issues of his day and of our day as well. But let me link the radical sociology and Marxism. Radical sociology is not boiled down just to Marxism, but that's really a key core of radical sociology. But link it to what's gone on in the last 50 or 60 years in society itself and actual politics. And let's remember something as well, that higher education in the university in capitalist society is capitalist schooling. We can't imagine that the university is some neutral, objective territory outside of capitalist society. It is part of it. So we had these mass struggles in the 1960s and 1970s that opened up the university in the United States and, of course, also worldwide, opened it up to people that had been locked out of higher education, such as in the United States, the African-American and Latino community and working class and poor people. But also these mass struggles out in society not just opened up that space in the universities, but also had an effect of radicalizing the disciplines. And the key discipline above all that was radicalized was sociology. So in the modern era, in the last 50, 60 years, that's really the roots of the rise of radical sociology. Radical sociology in the 1960s and 70s rediscovered Marx, the centrality of Marxist critique, anti-capitalist critique, and it was linked, this radical sociology, to these mass movements. So what happens subsequently is the counteroffensive from above, known today as the neoliberal counteroffensive, and that leads us towards capitalist globalization. And part of that counteroffensive was closing up those spaces in the university. So black studies programs, feminist studies programs, third world and ethnic studies programs are all being defunded. Chicano studies programs, they're all under attack. But also it meant making more conservative and pulling back from that radical edge in the disciplines, including in sociology. And so that's the backdrop to the rise of radical sociology and the attack that it has been under. And it shouldn't be surprising if radical sociology has been an instrument for critiquing capitalist society. And when capitalist elites launched this counteroffensive, they suppressed radical sociology. Because the key thing that I've just mentioned is this link between mass struggles, mass social and political struggles that you were referring to, and what happens at the university, both intellectually, in sociology, but also how the university is a space that's closed or opened, repressive or a potential for liberatory and emancipatory politics in the university. So what happens as part of that counteroffensive to close down the university again and turn the university into a site of neoliberalism and corporate control? Is that on the one hand, now the universities are funded by corporations. Even if they get public funding, the research agenda on universities, both in the natural and the social sciences, are dictated by corporate funding and the needs of global corporate capitalism. So the social sciences are defunded. The universities are privatized. And so that has a deep effect on radical sociology, the ability to practice and push forward radical sociology. And as this conservative bend takes over in the late 20th, early 21st century, you have the depression of Marxism, the notion that Marxism is outdated, and in its place comes, and I don't want to get too technical for the listeners, but in its place comes post-structuralism and post-modernism, which really doesn't involve a critique of capitalism, as you use the term, the Latin origins of the term radical, to get the roots up. It does not get to the roots of oppression and exploitation and what's going on in global capitalism. It leads rather to a politics on campus and off campus, an identity politics that at best is seeking equal representation and inclusion within the structures of power, within the existing capitalist society. And this, of course, is the agenda of diversity and multiculturalism. Words that sound nice because it is totally just to demand diversity and to demand multicultural participation. So there's nothing wrong with diversity and multiculturalism with a small d and a small m. But with a big D and big M, this has been part of the project of capitalist globalization and the neoliberal reconquest of the university. May I make one other follow-up point in this regard? I would like to say something about radical sociologists facing sanctions. If we pursue our radical sociology, I myself am privileged because I managed to get a job and tenure, so I myself am protected. But the new generation of sociologists and social scientists more generally being trained and getting their PhD now to go on and become professors face all sorts of sanctions if they lean towards a radical sociology or radical social science. First, they are not hired. They're not hired. And secondly, if they are hired, they have the struggle to get tenure and they are not tenured. And third, they are stigmatized. And fourth, their research is not funded because funding now is linked directly or indirectly to corporations, either directly from corporations or the military-industrial complex, or indirectly through foundations and fellowships that in turn are funded by the corporate capitalist structure. So the new generation has the choice of, do you want to get your career going or do you want to self-censor and renounce any radical sociology? That's the challenge we are facing right now.
William Robinson, in wrapping up here, I was wondering if we could bring the discussion back to the classic question of what can be done, but in a very specific sense. In other words, you're describing a global situation that's a capitalist global order. And of course, I think you would probably agree there are interconnections among many of these issues and crises. So again, for, say, a listener or even an emerging social movement activist, what would be the kinds of ways they might start to think about these issues and what, you know, individually as well as collectively, and what forms might this radical sociological approach take concretely on the ground? You know, I'm thinking, for example, of nuclear weapons or a climate breakdown. Those are huge issues. They're all interconnected with many of the issues of global capitalism. So how can we make sense of those issues in a way that an individual can see a way forward?
That's really the key question, and it's a question which I can only give my input into. I really can't answer the question because that's something for all of us to answer. But I think that the spread of resistance and social movements is already there, right? That's already taking place. What can we say are the limitations of what we're seeing unfolding now, and how can those people involved in these social movements, but also to tie it to myself as a radical sociologist, understand these limitations and overcome these limitations? So I want to repeat again that I think one of the limitations is all of these assumptions that came out of the late 20th century right-wing counteroffensive at a political and intellectual level that led to, well, in the academy, to post-structuralism, post-modernism, but in the mass movements to politics of diversity and multiculturalism, which is just too limited. And so you see now the Democratic Party in the United States trying to call itself the center of the, I mean, not even the far left of the Democratic Party, tiny little bit of the left that's there, but calling itself the resistance to Trump. But there's something else as well. We need hands-on, because all of these movements are here. The ecological, the environmental movements are there. The environmental justice movements are there. The high school students have been taking to the streets. We recently had the teachers' victory in West Virginia. All over, these movements are breaking out. What we need to be thinking about is how they link to each other. That is absolutely central, because each individual movement cannot question and challenge the system in itself. And when we talk about how they're linked to each other, we need two things. First, we need political organizations. It's not enough to have a social movement. We need them to have some political organization. You can call it a political party, you know, a third political party, a labor party. You can call it whatever. It's irrelevant what we call it. But we need some type of a vision of an alternative society, and that vision being articulated with some types of political organizations in which all of these social movements with their particular focuses, and they have to continue with the particular focuses, also link together with an anti-systemic critique. And again, that's where radical intellectuals come into the picture. I would just add one other thing. In the 1960s and 1970s, we also had study groups. They could be called any, you know, anything, but there were study groups, meaning that part of the mass movements was also reading and talking about theory. And we did have theory for the people then. I just finished teaching a graduate seminar in global political economy. But you know, one of the things we read there that the students were shocked to read, they're all radical students, but they have not been given the theory and they have historic amnesia. We read a tiny piece by Huey Newton, the founder of the Black Panther Party. Now, all kinds of problems with the Black Panther Party. The point is not to critique either Huey Newton or the Black Panther Party. But that article that we read of his, he was saying that in the Black Panther Party, there were study groups on Marxism. And so this was one of the most important revolutionary organizations of the 20th century in the United States. And the members of the Black Panther Party were encouraged to form study groups and to read Marxism and to read about revolutions around the world and socialism around the world. And so we need to, again, link up the mass movements with its too much spontaneity to projects, to actual projects of transformation, and to the theory and analysis that comes with studying the world.
William Robinson, thank you so much for joining us today on the Project Censored Show. We really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaigns.
That concludes this week's Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Special thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest. The Project Censored Show airs on about 40 stations around the United States. Archives of our shows can be found at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook, and we'll see you next time.
Wars fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxes on the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons build the capacity citizens. In the times for the master thief, combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love of the brothers and our sisters.